Hello and welcome to Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast, here to help inspire more people to discover and love the arts. This is a guest curator episode by Annie Yael Kwan as part of Noguchi Resonances. Hello, my name is Annie. I'm an independent curator and researcher, usually based in London, but I'm currently in Singapore due to the pandemic and family matters. My work has focused on contemporary and live art in relation to Asia, with an interest in archives, art histories, issues of identity, Southeast and East Asian diasporas, and questions around collectivity and transnational solidarity. I'm an associate of Asia Art Activism, which is based in London, and a council member of Asia Forum. Asia Art Activism is a research network based in London and working transnationally. It focuses on exploring the three areas of Asia, art, and activism, and its entanglements and proximities. Asia Forum refocuses global Asias as a lens with which to examine exciting artistic practices and critical urgencies. So I'm really pleased to be currently the digital researcher in residence at the Barbican and curating Noguchi Resonances, the online public program that will unfold from October to December this year, alongside Noguchi, an exhibition celebrating Japanese-American sculptor Isamu Noguchi. The residency has been an interesting opportunity to reflect and respond to Noguchi's artistic legacy, his transnational lived experiences, his voluntary incarceration at Poston, one of the Japanese-American internment camps during World War II, and the questions raised around his identity, positionality, and transnational and global perspectives on community and solidarity. So today I'm really pleased to have with me Professors Marcy Kwan and Ming Tianpo, and fellow curator and researcher Mika Maruyama, who are joining in from around the world. Marcy, I believe you're in the West Coast of USA, and Ming, you're in Rome, and Mika, you're still in Japan. So thank you for making time to join with me and being here despite the stretch across multiple time zones. So maybe as a way to kick us off, if you could please each explain a little bit about your practice, which would give us some context from where you work, and then perhaps then share with us your encounter with and perspective on Noguchi as an artist and person. Perhaps Marcy, if you could please do the honors.
Sure. So first of all, Annie, thank you so much for gathering us here today. My name is Marcy Kwan. I'm assistant professor of art history at Stanford, where I teach American art with a focus on Asian American artists. I'm also the co-director of the Asian American Art Initiative at Stanford University's Cantor Art Center, which is our campus museum. Which is dedicated to the collection, display, preservation, and research of artists of the Asian diaspora living in the Americas. For those of you who aren't familiar with Isamu Noguchi, he was born in 1904. His mother was Leonie Gilmore, an Irish-American writer and editor, and his father was Yone Noguchi, who was an acclaimed Japanese poet. And he had quite a distinguished artistic career, working, for example, with dancer Michio Ito in 1926, going to Paris and becoming an assistant of Constantin Brancusi, and making all sorts of works actually quite politically engaged in the 1930s, including Death, which is a pretty remarkable sculpture of Monel metal, rope, and wood that shows a lynched figure that was created as part of a kind of artistic response to the continued lynchings in the United States. One of the key moments in Noguchi's life is when he was voluntarily incarcerated in Poston, Arizona in 1942. And this brings us to the kind of larger story of Japanese incarceration by the United States during World War II. After the bombing of Pearl Harbor, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, then the president of the United States, signed Executive Order 9066 as a response to the kind of fear that Japanese people or people of Japanese descent living in the United States would somehow aid the war efforts of Japan. So there was written into the executive order was a specific discussion of potential sabotage of infrastructure. And practically what that meant was that approximately 120,000 people on the Western seaboard were forcibly rounded up and relocated. It was so quick that many of them had to make, you know, hasty arrangements for their property, their possessions, their homes. You know, very famously, they could bring only what they carried into first assembly centers, which were, you know, the infrastructure required to house and incarcerate so many people so quickly was being built right after the executive order. And so they were actually transferred first to these assembly centers, which were often located on racetracks because they had stalls for horses that families lived in, and then were located to one of 10 permanent incarceration camps across the United States. So Noguchi, who is living on the eastern seaboard at this moment, was actually not subject to Executive Order 9066. It was people only within a kind of designated geographic zone. But he met with John Collier, who is then the head of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which was heavily involved in this incarceration effort because a lot of the land they had was, you know, that they quote unquote managed through a project of native reservations, was actually the site of many of these incarceration camps because there wasn't a lot of infrastructure around. And he persuaded Noguchi to actually enter the incarceration camp at Poston in order to try to ameliorate the lives of the people there and also, you know, create work, you know, potentially kind of landscape designs and things of that sort. So when he's in the camps, he works on various things, including, in fact, a portrait bust of the actress Ginger Rogers. But he quickly finds that his kind of idealistic intentions of entering the camps are coming up against a really brutal reality of what it's like to be incarcerated. You know, he talks about both the material effects of this, of, you know, he was promised as much kind of material as he wanted in order to build and create. Obviously, that was much harder to come by there. And actually, his turn to wood at this moment as a chosen artistic medium is coming from what he can actually salvage from the camp's environment around him. But he's also, I think, acutely aware of the psychological effects. He talks about this sense of being kind of frozen in time in the camps where the rest of the world is kind of passing by around him. I want to make sure to say that a lot of this research has been done by the art historian Amy Lyford and Dakeen Hart, who is a curator at the Noguchi Museum. Amy wrote a wonderful book on particularly kind of illuminating this aspect of Noguchi's career. And Dakeen curated a show at the Noguchi Museum called Self-Interned. And so Noguchi is eventually completely disillusioned, granted a temporary furlough of a month, and just never returns to the camps and says, you know, this is an incredibly profound experience for him. He has this feeling when he emerges from his incarceration that he's constantly being watched. And in fact, later it was shown that the FBI ended up tracking him for 3 years after his incarceration. And so, you know, the question of why this is important today, I mean, first of all, just the story of incarceration and internment is such a key moment in the history of Asian American racialization for several reasons, you know, one, this notion of a kind of foreign agent, and it shows how geopolitical events are entwined with things that are considered more domestic, such as racialization. It also, you know, helps us understand a bit about the complexities of different ethnicities and cultural backgrounds in relation to these geopolitical events. There were actually propaganda images that were published during the war that were teaching, quote unquote, people how to distinguish between a Japanese person and a Chinese person, or an enemy alien or an ally. And I think that it is also just, you know, a story and a reminder of the depredations of the American government. Just as the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882 was the first kind of nationality-based discriminatory immigration law, which we see in subsequent executive orders, you know, this kind of forcible rounding up and incarceration under the more gentle term, which is, of course, a
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Euphemism of internment is still happening in the United States.
Thank you so much, Marcy. Thank you for that wonderful introduction and gives us such a good overview and summary of, in a way, the context in which Noguchi was working and why he made that decision, perhaps, to enter the camps. And it was just a few things you said that also sort of triggered thoughts in my mind, was that I think one point you made was the internment of the Japanese Americans all happened very quickly, you know, from the point of time that there was a decision and an executive order, and then it just happened. And I think that sometimes I think it's something worth thinking about, because sometimes we think that things move very slowly, but for some reason, when there's a kind of hostile governmental act, it's actually very quick. And so therefore, there isn't actually really the opportunity to respond as a community, to really consider what's going on. So I think that's something that is very sobering. I think the other thing also that you mentioned was, it's so interesting, you said that they were doing this kind of propaganda around how do you distinguish between a Chinese and Japanese person. But of course, that's not even actually possible to some degree, because of course the famous incident in 1982 was exactly about that, right? With Victor Chin's murder, because I think he's Chinese American, but he was mistaken for a Japanese, and there was a lot of anger because of the success of the Japanese car industry, which led to a car factory being closed down, I believe, in Chicago. And therefore, two disgruntled employees basically beat him up, and he was beaten to death, which is really horrific when we start to think about how these kind of broader geopolitical entanglements get played out in a kind of reality in terms of like social everyday life. Maybe right now, if I just kind of turn to you, Ming, perhaps if you could introduce yourself and you can hear a little from your perspective as well.
Hi, Annie. Hi, Marcy. Hi, Mika. It's so great to be with all of you and to think alongside you about these really important issues. And in the context of the Barbican's Noguchi show, I'm really thrilled that this will be taking place and that we'll be able to use this as a way to have some really important dialogues, both about global art history, but also about race and diaspora, and trying to understand what it means to have those, to think those two issues, those two different ways of understanding art history together. So I'm a professor of art history at Carleton University, and I'm the co-director of the Center for Transnational Cultural Analysis and also a scholar of the global post-war, with a focus on transnational models and histories that provide new structures for understanding and reconfiguring the global. Most of my publications have been on Japanese modernism, global modernisms, and diaspora. And the early part of my career was really spent thinking about Japanese post-war art history, and in particular, the Gutai Group, on whom I wrote a book published by the University of Chicago Press, and also co-curated an exhibition at the Guggenheim. And so more recently, I've been taking a different direction in my work, and I've been thinking about intersections between diaspora and the global through the concept of global Asias, with a project called Transversal Modernisms, the Sclade School of Fine Art, a study which reimagines how we write global art history through global microhistory, as well as writing a book on the Korean-Canadian artist Jin Mi-yoon. So you can see that I'm thinking about some global issues. I'm also thinking about diaspora issues. So I'm also involved in a lot of collaborative projects right now, which I think is really necessary for the future of global art history. And you know, this is because when we write global art histories, it's not possible just to take one perspective. It's really important, I think, to take multiple perspectives, to world our perspectives on global art histories. So I think it is really important for us to be having conversations like this, for us to be collaborating with people in different other fields. And one of the things that I'm doing is I'm part of a Reading collective that's producing a source book or a textbook called Intersecting Modernisms, and also part of a project called Worlding Public Cultures. So we've been cooking up many different things, Annie and I, including the very exciting Asia Forum. My understanding of Noguchi's work is very much inflected by the fact that I come from post-war Japanese art history, and the work of my colleagues, especially Bert Winter Tamaki, whose work really locates Noguchi's work within the spaces of both Japanese and American art. So within the material culture of Japan, clay, paper, wood, and its minimalist aesthetics, and also the nationalist politics of the American post-war art world, which continuously coded his work as Asiatic and Oriental. And so the work that Winter Tamaki does is brilliant in the way that he traces those histories and those visual languages and material cultures, demonstrating how Noguchi's work was inflected by geopolitics and the client-state relationship that Japan had with the United States after the war. So this sort of US-Japan aspect of the reception of Noguchi's work was really very present in Winter Tamaki's work. More recently, scholars have been thinking more about Noguchi, not just as a figure situated between Japan and the United States, but as a Japanese-American artist, which Noguchi articulates as a political category in his 1942 essay, I Became a Nisei, which he wrote for Reader's Digest, but which of course was never published. So in other words, in contemporary scholarship now, he's no longer just being understood within aestheticized frameworks of being between East and West, but through the political lens that Winter Tamaki brought to his work on US-Japan relations, and also the racialization of Japanese Americans in American life. So that is to say that we understand Noguchi now as an artist of global Asians. And so this interestingly also plays into Noguchi's design for a cenotaph memorial for Hiroshima, as he creates a design that would be visible from outer space, which then situates Hiroshima as a crime against humanity, which universalizes the bombing and sort of distances the issue of victimhood from Japan, so that we're thinking about, you know, not US-Japan relationships, but we're thinking about a crime against humanity in this work, which is quite an interesting shift that happens. So this is, of course, important because it reminds us that the intensification of racialization takes place in specific moments in history. This is something that Marcy brought up just now. And that diasporic experience is shaped by global events. So it's really important to think about global Asias as a model for thinking about diaspora and global histories as intersecting narratives and not as being separated, as we have had a tendency to do in scholarship in the past. So here with Noguchi, we see this playing out in the context of Japan as an enemy nation during World War II. But of course, it also makes me think of the racialization of Arab diasporas in the context of 9/11. And the racialization of East Asians in the context of COVID-19. And these are really important flashpoints to remember so that we understand that this isn't just a faraway history that can be forgotten, but really something that continues to be really relevant to experience today. And so Marchi's work on Noguchi and in turn makes an important contribution to this discourse, as does Amy Lyford's book, that she mentioned just now, as well as the exhibition by Akim Hart at the Noguchi Museum. So we're really starting to think differently about Noguchi recently. And I really like the way that Lyford's book understands Noguchi as a social activist, actually, and the ways in which she brings out his commitments to civil rights, labor, and then after Pearl Harbor and Executive Order 9066, which, as Marci mentioned, decreed the relocation of Japanese Americans to internment camps, she begins to understand Noguchi as addressing Japanese American and specifically Nisei or second generation Japanese politics. So in reading Noguchi's I Became a Nisei, a few issues emerge for me that are extremely resonant for us today. And the most urgent issue, which I will address today, is really the question of how does he become Nisei, which is a process that is for him both gradual, in that he writes about how he had a haunting sense of unreality, of not quite belonging, which drove him to seek answers among the Nisei. And also it's quite locatable. The first time he heard of Nisei as a community was when he received the Yamamoto Award for Nisei Achievement in 1940, which then connected him with a group of Nisei from Hawaii. And then the second time when he started to think about Nisei as an identity was after Pearl Harbor, when he felt his face suddenly connected to theirs. And he writes, "But it was only after December 7th, when I again found myself upon the shores of the Pacific, that I actively came to associate myself with the Nisei in any way. I sought them out in Los Angeles and in San Francisco out of realization of their special misfortune. I wished to help. I also wished to know the people who, because of war, I had suddenly become a part." So here we get at the core of Asian diasporic racialization, be it in the United States, Canada, Australia, Britain, and especially Europe, where I'm living now in Italy, which is that any claims to belonging or to homing are so fragile and are easily disrupted by geopolitical events. So I'd like for us to think a little bit about what the rise of anti-Asian hate in the context of COVID-19 tells us about diasporic citizenship. And the ugly phrase that, unfortunately, we've probably all heard, "go back to where you came from." And if that place is where you are and have been for generations, what does that actually mean? In the case of settler colonial countries like the United States, Canada, and Australia, that phrase becomes even more problematic as assumptions of white belonging are themselves premised upon indigenous dispossession, which we can see in the case of the Poston internment camps, which were built on indigenous land. So here, you know, we have this really difficult tension of entangled histories that we really need to sort of disentangle and understand as intersecting oppressions. So I think in the case of Noguchi, we are seeing an artist who used the critical potential of racialization as a site of empathy and of solidarity, both in terms of his voluntary internment, but also in terms of his larger social justice agenda. And the incredible 1934 work that Marci, you already mentioned, entitled Death, Lynched Figure, which addressed the problems of lynchings of African-Americans in the American South.
Thanks, Ming. Thank you for that. Thank you for your insights. I mean, there are certain things that you've said there that really kind of struck home, especially when you said, go back to where you come from. You know, as someone who's lived in the UK for a couple of decades now, I won't say exactly how long, it's very interesting, this question of how many years do you stay in a place before you're allowed to think of it as home? You know, even now, I think if you're on a long-term visa, you still have to prove that you have the right to work or that have the right to reside. And, you know, these laws, you know, are subject to change. You know, at some point, if they decide to change that system, then you'll be vulnerable again. And it's very interesting as well, I suppose, when for specific communities, especially diaspora communities where migrations are intergenerational, and this has happened through, you know, maybe an ancestor moving from China at some point or some other country at some point, and you've got these layers, then, you know, what is that process of indigenizing? Like, how does one relate to land? How does one make a home in relation to land? The other thing also that you mentioned was this entanglement between that specific context in which you're working in and then the geopolitics of how that racialization it might be framed. And it's certainly very true, because for myself, at least, you know, I feel the most Asian in context when that Asianness is being challenged, you know, because I never feel very Asian, because obviously I live in the UK, and I've never been very traditional. But recently, there was a conversation around someone sort of negating Lunar New Year. And suddenly, I felt very passionate about Lunar New Year, even though as a child, when I grew up, I was always, you know, a bit of a rebel and be like, why can't I wear black on Lunar New Year, you know, to a very frustrated mother. And all of a sudden, I was advocating very strongly for the fact that we should acknowledge Lunar New Year. And it's very strange how this sort of plays out, that you start to feel that you have to represent or take up space for something to be acknowledged, which is actually a very common practice globally. But why is that so difficult to accept in a particular context? So, you know, I think these sorts of anxieties emerge, especially during these moments of crisis or urgency. It'd be good to sort of think more about that together as well. But first, I would like to welcome Mika. Mika, if you could please share with us about your work and then tell us a little bit about your encounters with Noguchi.
Thank you, Anif. I am Mika Maruyama from Japan, and usually I'm based in Vienna, Austria, but currently I'm back in Japan. So I'm now speaking from Japan. I am an independent curator, writer, and researcher focusing on the intersection between queer and feminist art practices and media and technology. But my practices ranges from curating and gym making to collaborative artistic practices with interest in transcultural practices and counter-narratives that subversive normativity. And since 2018, I have been a co-editor of the Queer Feminist Art in Multiple Spirits in Japanese and English with artist Mayendo. And I'm also an active member of the Vienna-based artist collective, Mylin. Mylin is basically an artist collective, but also functioning as a platform of contemporary art, contemporary Asian art culture, especially in German-speaking countries, with a focus on queer and feminist positions to share and exchange experiences of racism, sexism, and homophobia, especially against Asian women's bodies. So it is very challenging for me to talk about Noguchi and his work and narratives in relation to my practice. But I believe that reflecting his transnational lived experiences is important in order to discuss issues of identity and belongings as Asian living outside of Asian countries. And as a Japanese person doing art practice, this talk triggers the difficulties how we narrate his artistic legacy and history. And we should also ask a question about which historical narratives should be discussed from which perspectives in the present day. But personally, one of my best memories of his work is Moelle Numa Park, which located in Hokkaido, the North Island of Japan. And this park is like a one whole big sculpture. And the park has a fountain, a glass building, and hills that form one gigantic landscape that can be enjoyed as a fusion of specific nature of the land and artistic intervention toward nature. So we need to use our bodies to climb up and down this sculpture, touching the ground and so forth. So it is really bodily experiences. I think as Min talked about intersectional aspects of how his work is seen and also the current tendency of leading of his works and practices. But in general, in Japan, Nongu is highly respected as an artist and designer who bleached the traditional Japanese culture and spiritual aspect of the culture and modernism. And most of the time, he has been related with issues of identity as Japanese American. And therefore, his narrative is always produced with his unique philosophy between West and East, and his strong wish for peace because of his experiences stuck in between Japan and the US, especially during the World War II. Yet, if we are talking about transnational or trans-Asian solidarity, narratives around Noguchi in Japan seem to focus on only a US-Japan trajectory. And of course, it is very male-dominated narratives. And for me, they are lacking different perspectives to reflect other experiences of the war and the Japanese commitment to violence toward other Asian countries that are more complex than this Japan and US relationship. Yet, ironically, his proposal for a memorial monument for the Hiroshima Peace Memorial Park was rejected because his proposal is too abstract. And some people say that because he is a Japanese American. So this is really like a difficult. In some point, he is really appreciated, but at the same time, people see him as a non-Japanese artist. So as a Japanese person based in Vienna, based in Europe, I have certain experiences that is closer in some ways with other Asian diasporas. That is what Noguchi might have faced in his life. But at the same time, I also have to confront Japaneseness and its history that I carry with my body and culture. So sometimes I can speak as just a person, but sometimes I am forced to speak as a Japanese, and sometimes I became an Asian, and sometimes I had to talk as a gendered person. So constantly, I feel that the positionality and identity are changing depending on what I'm talking and whom I'm speaking to or who is talking with. So for example, when I am working with other Asian diaspora or Asian immigrants within the artist collective Mailing in Vienna, I'm really aware that each of us has different positions and backgrounds and homes, and we never can say we are the same Asian descent. And our experiences and personalities are different depending on nation, class, gender or sexualities, and also depend on their relation to colonial and imperial inheritance in contemporary society. But at the same time, it is still important to build solidarity in terms of how we can survive and support each other against narrowed categorization or racism against Asian in Europe and globally. So it is really challenging and also exciting to talk about Noguchi today regarding not only artist legacy, but also his transnational experiences with his attempts and maybe failure from Taiwan's national and global perspectives.
Thank you so much, Mika. I think that's really interesting as well, what you were saying there about how in some way being this of a hybrid positionality, you're sort of there, you're here and there, but sometimes in neither places are you also considered at home and accepted, right? And so there's always this idea of code switching between different contexts to try to assimilate. And I think earlier, Marcy, you used the word agent as well. And so sometimes you are playing this sort of double agent, not necessarily politically, but you are always translating and mistranslating sometimes. And there's like slippages of meaning between different contexts that you are negotiating. And, you know, sometimes as a person, I find it playful sometimes, but also very tiring because of the amount of work you have to do to have your aesthetic appreciated or your context understood. I think the other thing also that's really interesting is that when you're talking about how we need to be very careful, on one hand, when we say Asian community, it speaks quite hopefully, perhaps to a sort of strength in numbers of solidarity, you know, that is a shared experience, as we were talking earlier about not being able to always differentiate between different Asian communities just by sight. But at the same time, we don't want to eradicate the differences between different cultural contexts or languages or lived experiences. And I think that's really interesting because recently, I think I had a conversation with someone where I think with reference, I think they were implying, because I was working with Asian art activism, they were saying, oh, well, you know, you just work with one community. And I thought at that moment, I had to kind of bite down really hard. I was like, one community? Like, what do you mean by one community? You know, because in Asian art activism, we have so many artists and curators, you know, that are connected to Vietnamese, Filipino, Malaysian, Singaporean, you know, communities, so of different heritages. So it was sort of perplexing at that moment to be sort of told that that's all subsumed under one category of Asian, because we happen to look at Asia as a lens. You know, you've brought so much to the table, and I'm just thinking, how do we unpack this? And maybe if we could start with sort of one very sort of big public event, which was that in 2020, at the tail end of 2020, in November, after 10 or 11 months where we've already experienced this global unfolding of the pandemic, which saw a corresponding spike of violence against Asian folks in the US and UK and internationally, albeit, you know, in response to the fact that there was a weaponization of the coronavirus and the language around it, put forward by President Trump. So what do we make of the fact that Noguchi's sculpture, Floor Frame, was installed in the White House Rose Garden, which makes Noguchi the first Asian-American artist to be collected as part of the White House collection by the Trump presidency, no less. Well, what do we make of that? And in a way, what do we make of the fact that Noguchi has come to the fore again at this time? You know, how should we understand this?
I mean, this is Marcy. I can just start by saying that when I saw that news pop up in my email digest, I just went, ew. It was like so repulsive to me. And I think that, you know, it does seem, though, to crystallize in the most kind of flagrant way, you know, that simply visibility and inclusion is not the political goal, and in fact could and is often used to manage dissent. And then the other thing that, you know, kind of came up for me is, I think the thing that it's a kind of thorny question that I'd be really interested in talking to all of you about, which is, you know, I think that the conventional art historical kind of approach to something like this, in, let's just say, placing an artist's identity in relation to their work, is to say that, well, the form is the most important thing. We can't just re-inscribe a narrative of this, this person's work to who they are, who they are in the world, isn't that just reinscribing the logic of racialization? And to a certain extent, I understand where that point is coming from, right? It's so striking to me the way that in talking about this event, it almost makes the sculpture invisible, and the very structure of the sculpture, which is actually in two pieces, it's called floor frame, but it's a broken frame, in that it's two distinct pieces that when installed appear to actually dip below the floor. And Noguchi is really interested precisely in categorization and space, and how it is that things don't just have an essence, but are defined in relation to each other. I think that's key to his interest in theater as well. For me, on one hand, there's a way in which the narrative that's ascribed to it by the White House in this acquisition is its own kind of really bad literal art history, simply saying that this work is reducible to this artist's identity, and that's why it's important. And at the same time, I think that we can't separate this interest in categorization, this interest in space, from someone who has experienced incarceration and actually physically experienced the physical parceling of space and the way that that enacts force. And so I think that for me, it's always this question of kind of keeping both of these things that might appear to be opposed to each other, let's just say kind of form and lived experience, but understanding that the relationship is quite complex and not a kind of one-to-one relationship.
I think for me, there are two issues I'd like to respond to in terms of what you were just saying. And one of them is this question of inclusion when we build art historical narratives. All museums these days have DEAI committees, and they're all thinking about, how do we diversify and include more? In fact, I might even say that this podcast itself is the result of a DEAI effort, and we need to think about what that actually means. If we think about inclusion in these kinds of projects, we absolutely also need to think about what it means to construct new narratives, that we can't just be slotted into a structure that has already been predetermined, that are reproducing structures of domination, our inclusion allows those logics to be perpetuated. We really need to think of ways to interrupt and rebuild new narratives so that we're decolonizing entire structures and we're decolonizing the ways in which we build those narratives. So that's the first thing. And the second thing that I thought was really important about your critique there of the Trumps was the way in which you talked about aesthetics and the way in which I think it's critical for us to think about aesthetics and social justice together. It's not one or the other. These two ways of looking and ways of knowing can coexist. And over the weekend, I was very lucky. I went to Amsterdam and saw this exhibition called Expressionism Colonialism, which was an exhibition of Emil Nolde and Kirchner. And they were bringing together objects from various collections in Germany that Kirchner and Nolde had looked at. And they were thinking very much about the colonial histories of those objects, how they were collected, how Nolde and Kirchner would have had access to them. And there was a shift where, the history of colonialism was foregrounded and Nolde and Kirchner were decentered. And one of the critiques that that emerged of this exhibition was, the question, can we still look at these artworks? Can we still see beauty? in these artworks, right? And I would ask the question, what is beauty? Can we see aesthetic beauty, and can we see it in the context of ethical beauty as well? And what does it mean for us to decenter aesthetic beauty, even just for a moment, so that we understand that these histories, they're not innocent histories, and that we need to look differently, to retrain the eye, right? And so I think that for me, in thinking about aesthetics and social justice together, it's really important to be able to do both so that you don't lose the objects, but also so you don't lose the history.
Thank you so much, Marcy, for your thoughts, and Ming for intervening with your insights on that. There's so much to unpack there. So before we talk about aesthetics and ethical justice, I want to loop back to just clarifying one point, because we've touched on this really important question here about inclusion and visibility, especially when we all work with institutions, and we have, you know, we know there's a kind of well-known critique now of many institutions and their colonial histories and so on. So my question here is, firstly, why did Collier invite Noguchi? Like, was there an explicit reason that was made known anywhere about why the invitation was issued? That's the first question. And I guess the second thing about thinking about working with institutions, I think, you know, there's always this difficulty, because for practitioners like myself, and I'm sure Mika, you experience this as well, is that often, you know, the invitations come as opportunities. And especially when you're an independent practitioner, the opportunities are precious, because, you know, they're a way of making your voice heard, or surfacing certain narratives around experiences. But at the same time, then there are questions around, you know, what is representation if it becomes exploitation, right? So what is the point of self-exploiting just to be visible? And so it raises questions around, I think, what also Noguchi experienced, which was his lack of resources, the fact that he didn't receive the support, even though he was invited to take up that role. So he wasn't supported in fulfilling the mission that he was invited to take up. So I find that really interesting, this conundrum of why he was invited in the first place if they were not going to support him.
The history of arts in the camps, I think there's still a lot of work to be done in terms of research, but one thing to know is that a lot of the artistic programs were government run, and it was to occupy people's time. And this is not the same as programs run by people like Chara Obata. Chara Obata ran artistic programs for kind of his fellow prisoners. But the government, you know, and all of these government agencies, one, have this kind of philosophy of arts as a form of improvement. And that's coming from the philosophy of people like, of pragmatist philosophers like John Dewey. But also they were putting people to work, for example, making camouflage nets for the war effort. So that's one thing, is the way in which arts were actually functioning in the camps feels like a really important future direction of research. So in terms of this other question, which I would actually love to hear Mika respond to, because you've already in some ways articulated it so beautifully. But I guess I just say that I think a lot about this sentence that Anne Chang wrote in The Melancholy of Race, that identity is the grounds upon which both discrimination and progress are made. And it's like, what do we do with that?
Yeah, it's really challenging things. But maybe I can talk why I'm also doing this Mylim artist collective. And usually today, of course, I'm talking as a member, but usually we are working like active as anonymously. So like people not really knowing who are in Mylim artist collective. Because we thought this all the time, you know, like constantly we are categorized as Asian, Japanese, whatever, or, you know, female, trans, whatever. And it's really like tricky things for any artist and any curators who has different background based in Europe, for example, because this difference, of course, as a kind of one from one perspective, is advantage because we have some different voice that kind of showing diversity in the white society. But at the same time, we are also doing the different things, not only talking about our identity. That's why we kind of decided to fund Myelin Collective, because one person voice is not enough. And therefore collective voice is really important, because this is not talking about me or like one person identity, but we are talking how these race and gender categories have been constructed within this structure. So, and then I think this is both in society, like general, and also the art institution is the same. So like we are kind of all the time playing with this game, or I don't know, like we should say game or not, because it's really like violent sometimes. So like it should not be the game, but we are playing with this kind of problem that, okay, we have to make our voice visible, but at the same time, we also have to hide ourselves in some points. And then, for example, Eduardo Gleason is quite an important difference, for example, because he's talking about, because the white subject is transparent. So that's why we need to, like, sometimes don't need to explain everything what we are doing. So this is, for me, like, kind of strategy that in some point we have to open the door in order to construct new narrative for ourselves, but at the same time we also hide ourselves in some point.
I like it that you used the word game there, because obviously I think a lot of us are now watching Squid Game, which popular cultural reference there, but and I suppose that also comes to mind to some degree, because when we think about visibility and inclusion, you know, we're thinking also about competition to some degree, and there's a kind of scarcity mindset of being like exceptional in order to be included in the canon, in order for you to be validated by a mainstream institution, to be allowed to do work within that institution or to be seen in that institution. And so there are these kind of interesting tensions between being seen and being valued, and therefore the work is being allowed to be supported, to be made, and so on. So I just wanted to go back to another point that Ming, you made about how when we're working with institutions, and I sometimes wonder if it's almost inevitable that we will have these moments of working with institutions. So what then are the strategies of interruption, as you were suggesting, or how do we change the landscape or change the game plan if we are going to take up these challenges? Because at the same time, I can see there are advantages of doing that, because you know, you have possibly a platform and you're reaching out to a different kind of audience, but in which case then how do we negotiate that communication? And as Mika, you were saying, sometimes we are trying to bring some issues to the fore, and yet there are some aspects that have to be hidden. And I also think that's really interesting from a project I was working on recently, where because the artist was working in such a different cultural context with multiple migratory experiences, the institution I was working with felt nervous that the audience would not understand what was that experience. And so it was very interesting, this process of how they were asking for a lot of information in order to nail down exactly what this multiple migrations that his family, the artist's family, experienced. And I was wondering how much more information do they need? How much more detail do they need, you know, in order to understand the work, when precisely, in a way, the artist was trying to say that because of these ruptured histories in the family background, there are these spaces of ambiguity, spaces of ambivalence, which are part of the experience that he's trying to convey in the work, exactly. But yet there was a real need by the institution to pin down exactly what this work means, you know, and that makes me, of course, think of Gleason's piece, you know, about the right to opacity, that even though I am a racialized subject in some context, it's not necessarily my burden to have to explain everything to you either, which can't be done anyway in reality. So I just wonder whether you would like to comment on, or anyone would like to comment on that.
Sure. Thank you so much for that excellent question, Annie. And it's a fraught one, one that I brought upon myself because of my comment earlier, and one that I think about quite a lot, actually. I should say first that I am somebody who does work with institutions. I believe in institutions. I think it's absolutely important for us to support institutions, given the enormous platform that they have in the space of public culture, right? So for me, the starting point is, how can I help? And, you know, the other question, the other thing is, you know, I have many colleagues who are thinking about how we break down the institution. How do we blow up the institution, right? How do we get rid of institutions altogether? Blow off the roof. But if you do that, then you have no roof, right? It takes a lot of work to build these institutions. And I think that for us, it's really important to recognize there's no such thing as being outside of history. And if you blow up the institution, then you'll have something else to deal with. So I think that what's critical is a project of reform, which, you know, is always fraught because, you know, as we were discussing earlier with DEAI, these inclusion projects always have a tendency to perform inclusion more than they actually enact them. And my view on that is actually not that it's lip service, but rather that it's a kind of aspirational project. And, you know, I think that's important to remember that, you know, if you're aspiring to making change, if you're aspiring to justice, as long as the work is being done, that kind of slow incremental change does eventually result in, you know, more just institutions. The question is, how do we get there, and how do we get there a little bit more quickly, right? I think that it's important for us to think about how we engage in that hard work, how we, to think about can museums hire more BIPOC curators in order to make cultural change within those institutions. But also for those of us who don't work in institutions. I mean, I work in a university, but not at a museum. But so I have an inside-outside relationship to museums. How can we on the outside then use our positions to interrupt, to sort of provide useful advice, to think alongside like-minded curators, rethink the ways in which these institutions represent artists and histories of color?
You know, for me, Annie, the situation you just described about an institution wanting more and more and more explanation, you know, my question is, explanation for whom? You know, what does that say about the audience you're assuming is coming to this exhibition, right? Personally, what I've come to is, one, there is no outside to the structure. You know, it's like, it's all like settler colonialism in the United States, you know? So that's the first thing. And then starting from that place, I just ask myself, well, where is it that I'm standing right now? You know, I'm standing on Muwekma Ohlone land, but I'm also standing on land that was purchased by an institution through the wealth that was created by the Transcontinental Railroad, which was built through the underpaying, the drastic underpaying and mistreatment of Chinese laborers. So for me, I guess the two things about working at institutions that I'm at least starting from is, who are we serving? You know, who is our audience? And also to not pretend like the institution that I'm at is somehow apart from these histories, but to actually foreground that in everything we do.
Marcy, I thank you for that really powerful and important history, the exegesis of the place where you stand, which I think is, you know, so necessary. I think that question that you're asking, who is this for? Who are we serving, is really important. And it's a question that can also be asked of large institutions, in the sense of, how can we rethink who they're for? And I think that that's really a really important way of reimagining not just who is represented and what diverse artistic collections are represented, but who does the museum speak for? And how is the museum being rethought to imagine togetherness differently? So that it's not really just about, you know, white audiences, but really thinking in a much broader sense to understand, how do we connect communities and what are those communities?
You know, I think that was a really important question here about how we can't necessarily be outside of the system, because the whole thing is one system. And that, of course, makes me think about how quite often I've been hearing a lot about the politics of refusal. And I think that there is some, that can be a useful strategy at specific moments, you know, where the conditions are untenable, and, you know, that, so therefore you can exercise that politics of refusal not to play in a game that doesn't have the right conditions. But I think to completely disengage, I think, is what you're saying, that we can't disengage from the public narrative, because we're trying to be part of that public narrative and speak to it in order to hopefully alter it. And I think that, you know, it goes back to some really kind of everyday things that I think about when I'm taking up a project with an institution. You know, going back to Noguchi's issue, are there sufficient resources? You know, will there be enough support? Is there someone, you know, engaging with you because as a project unfolds, there are many anxieties or things that you haven't thought of that you might need support in executing, you know, that make that whole working process better. I also thought about how, you know, we talk about these days, especially in activist spaces, holding safer spaces. And I think it's really important that, you know, museums are focusing on that or honoring that within, like, even the communications of the working process, that there are safer spaces that you can feel that you know that there's going to be mutual respect and in the language that's being used. And I think these are just some of the starting points, in fact, you know, and I think that makes me slightly, I don't want to use the word disillusioned, but sometimes I'm a little disheartened that, you know, the starting position is that far back, you know. Beyond that, I think, you know, I was also reading up about how engagement with institutions, we're not looking only to be included in certain conversations, but how, whether the invitation comes with a commitment to a sort of longer term engagement, a longer term unfolding of, you know, how the institution sees its position and the narrative it wants to create. And that's something I'm still trying to learn. How do you navigate those kind of negotiations? And I just wonder whether you've encountered that in your work, Mika, or, you know, the way that you've negotiated that.
I think I am not really kind of institutional person, maybe, because I'm more working as independent. And when it comes to the collective, we also kind of working as independent. And we have more perspective as a grassroots, or more kind of focusing on the community building, because I think this is the most important thing, that as this collective who are focusing on Asian diaspora, because we don't have any narrative. First of all, we have to kind of make, like, form the community that we really can speak what we want to say. Because all the time, you know, being alone, talking just about this, you know, the problem, people just say, like, okay, it's not important. And then you are the only one who are saying, but it's with the collective voices, I think this is also like how we change. And we kind of founded the collective in 2019. And since then, we have been kind of doing different projects, and you know, sometimes in art museum and sometimes art kind of artistic land space and also the public space. So like we have different audiences. And also like for me, the most important thing is that how the audience uploads to us. For example, in the museum, of course, nobody uploads to us, but in a smaller space, we sometimes can talk each other. And then public space, it's really interesting for me and for us, especially since we have social networking service, for example, Instagram. So like a younger generation just came to us, even they don't, you know, they have no idea about what art, you know, what is art or like what is contemporary art. They just come to us, okay, you know, like this is the first time that we really see Asian like art practices in Vienna, for example. So like for us, this is quite interesting, like how much these narratives are deleted from institutional narratives and how much we have to do in from the bottom level and the grassroots. So like I believe that, of course, it's really important that we think we have to, you know, like grow with institutions, but at the same time, we also have to kind of take care of our environments and the condition that we are live in. So this is what I kind of really feeling now. And especially as Annie also brought up some issues since the corona happened, ironically, like we, of course, we are visible because of course we are the only or like, you know, a few voices in Austria or in German speaking country talking about Asian racism. That's why we are now more easy to connect each other. So this is like interesting that of course it's so kind of the painful to deal with all the time with these issues as artistic practices. And of course we face this like different violences, but at the same time, this visibility really allow us to connect or build a network with other artistic practices and artists and networking, not on also outside institutions. So for me, like this, like both different like positions, different networks, quite important to talk about these issues, because this is also like for me, it's always thinking that what is art now and how we kind of not define, but how we kind of see art and activism. So like how we kind of really think about intersection of art and other field to talk about these issues, because I mean, there's no place only for art, I think.
I think that's a really good moment. Perhaps we can link this back actually to what you were saying earlier, Ming.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
About aesthetics and the role of aesthetics and ethical justice, which I thought was a really interesting way of thinking, you know, another way of thinking about art and activism. And, you know, I just wanted also to raise recently that I read this review of Noguchi's work by Jonathan Jones, who's a British art critic. And he was very scathing about Noguchi's artistic legacy, you know, but his name rang a bell. And so I was looking it up and I thought, suddenly I remembered, oh, I see. He was also someone who wrote about the exhibition Artisan Empire by the Tate back in 2016. And he wrote about it in sort of in a way that wasn't very critical at all, just said it was very exciting. And on another occasion, he had called you know, the very respected artist Bhupen Kaka, a ham-fisted hack. So it made me question about, you know, who is writing art criticism, and, you know, how are they viewing these works? What are their references that they're bringing in the way they're reading these works? And I also linked that to an issue that I had personally not long ago when Ming, you know, when we were forming Asia Forum, and there was a discussion around, you know, how do we work with a PR company in order to promote the work that we're trying to do? And it was actually such a challenge because we realized that most PR companies, art PR companies in the UK, are very, in a sense, Eurocentric. And so they have no real way of engaging with what those narratives are. And so they can't really identify with them, and perhaps they bring a very different aesthetic lens. And I was also surprised at that time because I said, oh, perhaps the importance of doing such a project would be because of this rise of violence against Asian people internationally. And the comment at the time in response was, oh, I think that's exaggerated. It's probably like the, you know, the incidents of violence on the streets of Poland that were far more exaggerated than in real life. And I remember thinking, this is strange. And later I kind of took a step back and I thought, okay, he probably thinks that, you know, as a white middle-class male, because that's what the papers tell him, you know, they're not all the incidents are reported. And I know about these incidents because they are shared through, say, educational networks or grassroots communities networks. And so not all of these incidents make it to a mainstream broadsheet. So from his perspective, yeah, there are not that many incidents. So they sound, this whole issue about the rise of violence against Asian people sound exaggerated. So I think it's really interesting. There's a kind of gap between, you know, various contexts and then who is writing about it. And I just wondered if you'd like to comment on that.
Annie, thank you so much for bringing this up. Thank you for connecting the dots for us of Jonathan Jones's review of Artist and Empire, as well as his review of Bhupen Kaka. I think it's really important for us to look at these three reviews together and to understand what he's doing there, and to show us the importance of thinking about the role of art criticism in creating public narratives as a kind of public storytelling that changes the way that the general public will think about culture and who is a legitimate cultural producer and who is not a legitimate cultural producer. I just wanted to sort of acknowledge what Mika said earlier about the importance of grassroots networks and alternative institutionalisms, thinking about different ways of being together and to build solidarities and communities. I think that's very, very important. And perhaps the answer is, you know, not that either the large institutions or the grassroots networks need to sort of dominate in a sort of larger strategy, but rather that they work together so that there are these safe spaces within grassroots networks, and that the sort of larger space of the public sphere, such as, you know, the art criticism that you read of Jonathan Jones, that art criticism plays an important role in defining that public sphere, as do museums. And so, you know, I think it's really important for us to think critically about that public sphere and to critique the fact that he is building narratives that are creating a certain kind of narrative about the primacy of British, European, and American art, which excludes art from other places and thinks about those narratives in very particular ways.
I think, Mika, you described Noguchi's Park in Hokkaido, which I, you know, for me is an aspect of his work that brings a kind of embodied playfulness. And I think that's really precious to some degree. And in a way, I think that was also part of the work that he showed at the Venice Biennale. And I wonder if we could speak a little bit more about that, because there's a certain joy as well in certain his use of materials and the form that he embraces, experiments with. And I wonder whether we can rethink, how do we reclaim that way of speaking of aesthetics that is not the Eurocentric, more kind of normalized standard of aesthetics?
Yeah, this is a big interest of mine. And it's an open question to me. But the way that I've been thinking about it lately has been that the problem is not aesthetics itself. It's the hierarchy that's created. And it's hierarchy, you know, it's the sense that something is beautiful, therefore it is just, you know, as opposed to there being multiple systems and structures of evaluation, none of which, not one has any kind of primacy. So the problem with a museum or with art criticism more generally, you know, is that it's embedded in this structure of value making and distinction, right? That is, as I think Ming really brilliantly elucidated, you know, like brings certain types of aesthetics or practices to the fore. But I think that at the core of that is the function of these structures is to create a sense of one practice or one narrative or one aesthetic being superior to another. And that's the structure that I feel like we need to be fighting against. And the question is, how do you do that? I mean, I think that even in talking with all of you, you know, what becomes clear is that we all have very different practices, which is actually incredible, you know, and really exciting because we are finding ways, or I think trying to find ways to do this that isn't about a kind of form of mastery over all spheres, but that is, you know, located in what we're able to do. And that's the emphasis on collaboration, Mika, that you were talking about. So I guess that for me, like, it's not about like destroying a museum, but trying to put the museum on par with those kinds of local collectives, Mika, that you're talking about, as both being crucial arbiters, and, you know, not like saying this critic has all the power in the world, but being like, no, like, this is just one voice among many.
Thank you so much for that, Marcy. And thank you everyone for this conversation, because I guess it's been really making me think about how we work in our everyday lives, how we work with institutions, how do we work with alternative spaces, how do we work within ourselves and our communities, and how all of these are interconnected within a kind of broader ecology. And I guess it's making me also think of, you know, this phrase we've been really talking about within AA, Asian joy, because the last 2 years, you know, the narratives have been so dominated by grief and loss, which, you know, has been experienced on a global scale, of course. But in some way, you know, we're finding moments of respite by our shared happiness in some, you know, for example, in food, you know, for example, perhaps in pop cultural references. And these moments are really precious. But I think when I think about radical joy, you know, it also makes me think of the wonderful text that you wrote, Ming, which has always inspired me since I read it, which I would love to read if that's okay, just a small little paragraph, because it makes me think, because I, you know, often as curators, we use this word radical a lot, like radical this and that, you know, but what does that really mean? And so this text is a challenge, I think, to have a more expansive idea of what a radicality might mean. So just to read from your text, it says, "To be radical is to think beyond the disciplinary logics of art history, rooted in 18th century nationalism, nation building, the creation of national collections, national archives, and even the logics of national competition enshrined in large-scale biennales. It is to imagine new scales of analysis, to seek new ways of building art histories, to find new connections and resonances, and to imagine new structures of affiliation. It is to find new modalities that enable us to read archives against the grain and to understand their absences in order to tell stories that have been suppressed, forgotten, or never imagined to have existed. It is to seek transversal articulations of urgencies that appear parallel, relational comparisons, decenterings, and worldly affiliations, which help us to think imaginatively about how we are connected rather than forced apart, to dig deep into the scorched ground, to reveal the invisible mycorrhizal networks that link our roots, the radici, the radical foundations of our hard histories. And I think maybe that, you know, I find that so encouraging that it requires us to dig really deep into ourselves and into the work that we do as a kind of self-reflexivity and questioning, like, why do we do something? How do we do something? You know, what is the impact of what we do?
I don't know. I think I might want to say a little bit about this passage that you just read, which was in some senses a call to think about radicality, not as being at the forefront of a struggle, but as a kind of rootedness that thinks relationally about how we emplace ourselves vis-a-vis our interlocutors. So that, you know, we are understanding that it's not necessarily that we have to sort of stake out the most radical position, but that what's really, what's most important to me, at least, is how do we proceed with care to build new worlds together in such a way that includes multiple voices, even the ones that we don't necessarily agree with.
Marcy Meeker, is there anything else you want to say as well?
I think this is really like beautiful that Min said now, because I think sometimes we also have to accept our ugly feeling that this, you know, like, of course, being kind of sometimes competitive, but at the same time, we care about ourselves, but at the same time, you know, like other people. So like this, it's not just one, you know, like a bit, you know, clear feeling or emotion, but we all the time complex and things. And then I think always this is, of course, in everyday life, but at the same time, art is all about this kind of accepting these kind of difficult situations and negotiating, and also like acknowledging which kind of power relation we have now. So I think I really like kind of also like reflect what I'm doing and also how we kind of position in this kind of these narratives. Yeah.
Thank you. This conversation has been incredible. And there's just so much to take away to meditate on in terms of the way we work. And I really liked also, you reminding us that, you know, it's about digging deep and digging into our rootedness, which of course is really one of those conundrums for the migrant, right? How do we gain ground? How do we grow roots? You know, how do we relate to land? So much there again to think about in that image. So I want to thank you again, my guests today, Professors Marcy Kwon and Min Tiampo, and my fellow curator, Mika Mariama. So thank you for joining me from across the world at all hours. It's been an amazing conversation and a wonderful way to kickstart this program. So hopefully we'll get to reconvene at another time. But thank you very much. Thank you for listening to Nothing Concrete and this special episode as part of the Noguchi Resonances Digital Residency. Please subscribe to Nothing Concrete on Acast, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. So I really want to thank you for being here today.